everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are, and shalom, and welcome to the Pardes Institute, where we're meeting with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. It's good to see you.
It's great to see you, and it's also great to be seen by you, Lirot V'Lahiraot, here in Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh. And it is a super hot time out there in Israel. It is just, it's just
things are swirling.
I mean, we're talking about a situation in which, let's just like kind of enumerate them. We're talking about, first thing, the Prime Minister of Israel coming out with a type of bombshell announcement, but other people see it as just a political announcement, which is not a bombshell at all. But in any case, he's saying the words sovereignty over the settlements, the Jewish neighborhoods in Judea and Samaria, starting with the already consensus Jordan Valley,
yep,
and the annexation of it, or the sovereignty of Israel over it. There's some difference between those words.
Yeah.
But in any case, he says that. Moments later, he's at another political rally. Rockets are starting to come out of Gaza.
Right. Hamas is clearly voting for Bibi or right. against. It's hard to know, actually, to interpret that vote.
Right. Well, the way they were planning it, and you have to be really media savvy, which is really part of the warfare today. And
yes.
And in the trenches out there, it's like, okay, when can the news media report this? Is this too late for the nightly news? It's like,
oh, it was precision. It was right. a precision act.
Right.
It was precision. This wasn't a couple of Yahoos who let one rip.
Right, exactly. They aimed it at where the Prime Minister was doing his thing, speaking. By the way, just an interesting aside. My beloved wife and I were watching the Prime Minister's announcements on the regular Israeli channels.
Uh-huh.
Well, they were talking over him.
Of course they were. They're Israeli.
They were talking over him. The news analysis was giving analysis as he's speaking. And my wife was flustered and I was annoyed. And it was just like, hey, we're listening to, we want to hear what he says in au naturel. And then we'll.
No respect.
Well, what do you do in that moment? Well, where do you get your feed? Where do you get away from him?
I would rely on you for that information.
Okay, so here we are. We're like, this is a real modern moment. We're in our kitchen. We're watching on the computer, because we don't have a TV. We're watching on the computer the Netanyahu announcement on the regular TV through the internet. They're talking over him. What do you do? I said to her, pause this, whipped out my cell phone, went to @Netanyahu on Twitter.
For sure, they were broadcasting just him.
Right, hit the live stream button on his feed, and there he was without being talked over, right? I was, and like I knew it, too. I'm like, this is the way to do it. You know, so we're living in a very modern where you get the broadcast from the dude himself. Moreover, by the way, I had a realization that the Prime Minister's office in Israel is partially a roadie show, like a road show with a full road.
When I say crew, this, yeah, for sure.
There's a full-on crew that takes things. I asked them, I said to the crew, who was recently covering, I'm like, when is your next gig? They're like, our gigs are every other day. We're going to take down the stuff now. We're going tomorrow morning to set up, and the next morning or the next day, he's coming in for the show. What is the show? Well, that's a whole other staff of,
right. of content.
Content
and political advisors. And
right.
They're like, we just do the framing.
Right. We do, right. And what is that framing? It's at least three tents. Okay. I'm not going to go into it, but it's a whole security thing and a whole apparatus and a stage and a setup and the mics. The whole thing.
Cold water.
And of course the media stage.
Oh
behind.
Yeah,
it's a show.
Yes,
it's a show. It's yes. And I don't mean that in any derogatory sense. I mean that in the show it's business like, sense of show.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know? this is the reality of governance in general, but democracy in particular. So long as the average person has even the slightest influence on who gets to play the role of star in the political drama, then it will be a show.
Yeah. I could have guessed that if you would have asked me, but I was just amazed
just
at the reality of it. You
know,
just like
on,
this is like a circus.
The show rolled into your town. Recently.
It rolled into my town, and it did also a lot of damage, by the way, in its physical wake.
I bet, because they're not gentle.
They're not gentle.
They just crush whatever's in their way. Huh?
It's crazy. So
you can squeeze that in there.
They just drill and do all kinds of stuff and tons of damage, grass and all kinds of stuff.
It's like yeah,
ground gets sunken.
Send us the bill, huh?
Something like that. It's really a wild business.
Yeah.
In any case, it's
good to be the king.
It's tough to be the king.
Yeah, I know.
It's an indentured servitude and not exactly just a privilege.
Well, it's funny you say that because I'm at the risk of outing myself as a consumer of popular culture. Have you ever seen Iron Man 2 by any chance? Did you watch any of the Marvel comic movies?
You know, it happens to be that you and I had a talk about Marvel comics, and then it happens to be that during after that I hung out with you, when we talked about that, then I did indeed go back into that world.
Indulge a bit.
I indulged in it a little bit, and I actually found that the Iron Man series, which was much better than the other stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of one of the cores. My reason I raise it is because in Iron Man 2, the villain says to Iron Man, who Iron Man thinks he's defeated him. He says, no, because I made God bleed, meaning he brought Iron Man down a peg, and he said, now the world will tear him apart.
Right.
And that's exactly what we see. So long as the king is this inviolate sort of shining knight in armor, you don't have to take him down. All you have to do is make him bleed. And as soon as he looks human, then the envy and the smallness of all the people around him emerges, and a lot of the knives come out.
Yes, but for a person like me, when I see that, I basically think about those other people. How little you are, how petty tyrant you are.
Oh, for sure.
How small you are.
And this is one of the great challenges, again, of democracy, is that it is so easy to gain power by playing to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, but not with me.
With you personally. Unfortunately, not everybody's like you.
I get turned off from it. I'm just like, you are so small. Yeah. Even when they were cutting him off, I'm like, you want to hear your voice so much that we can't even clearly hear an articulation of a new policy potentially. Just zip it for a second, okay? You know, and you know, I turned them off.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. There's Iran. There's Hamas, Hezbollah.
Yeah, the drone wars, huh?
There's the drone wars. Not only that. In our ally, the United States, things are not everything is calm in Camelot. Okay,
oh, sure not.
Right. So you have this president, whatever you think of him. And I'm talking about this totally neutrally. He is, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a non-stable element, like a...
loony?
No. I'm not saying that. I did not say that.
I know you weren't. Taking advantage of the moment.
Something that can explode, an element.
He's volatile.
That's Lakuli Alma. Nobody disagrees with that. Nope. He wouldn't disagree with
and
that.
And he shoots from the hip.
He's volatile. That's what volatile means. You don't exactly know, and I'm not sure he exactly knows. But in any case... our ally of people on the right, John Bolton, is gone one way or another. Greenblatt, who we've come to respect, is
also out.
From my sources, I understand that it's really a financial thing in part because of, guess what? Yeshiva tuition.
Okay? No, really? Oh, the reality of American Jewry.
Yeah. I'm happy to help out in this global world crisis issue, but I can't get my kids to yeshiva. So there's that, and then there's actual elections coming right up in the country. My friends, our mutual friend Shmuel Goldman, called me to discuss the voting options. And yeah. People do call, you know, to talk it out.
So what did you push?
Well, I pushed the right, meaning to say I gave the pluses and minuses for the three right wing parties. That are
what's the third
the Otzma, which is now now
they're looking to actually going to cross the threshold.
So I spoke about them, you know, reasonably, and there are three parties, and there's pluses and minuses, and I'm sure our listeners could discuss all three. Anyway, and then there's if you're tuned into the spiritual clock, there's Rosh Hashanah is coming.
Oh yes, Elul is ticking away here.
It's ticking away. And you feel it.
Oh, yeah.
And you know you're going to be standing in front of God.
Well, my anniversary is Yud Elul.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always a good marker of like, wait, we're one-third done. Like, what just happened? More than one-third.
Right. We're like, you can look at the moon, and she beautiful moon last night. And like,
looking at the moon in Elul is always a little intimidating.
Right. It's intimidating. And it's like, if you're serious
about
full.
It. Yeah.
If you're serious about it, and if that's part of your thing, if that's part of your understanding of what Israel is and the political realities and all that, and you can somehow, that's what I mean by the smallness. If you could step out of their little arguments and little constant jabs, and if you could step back up and remember God's big dream and the coming home of the Jewish people, the land of Israel, the creation of a Jewish state, which is supposed to be a light unto the nations, et cetera.
The whole third kingdom.
Right. The whole thing. And you remember that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And then it clicks into like, what are we doing on the personal level or a national level, even on tshuva?
One hopes. Yeah. And it's the image you gave, I think, is so important, is that Elul is a time, and it's a strange movement to do two things. First of all, you got to get down into the nitty gritty. You got to look at your life with a fine-tooth comb and fine-tooth comb, sorry, and say, like, where am I at? And where is it working? Where is it not? At the same time, the only way to do that without just drowning is to also pop up into the greatness of the horizon, which is way above that, right? And say, like, what a gift. What a gift that this is the way God created the world that we have this time. And what an even greater gift that God told us about it. That our calendar is built on a spiritual rhythm which reflects the topography of creation. It's not simply a way of marking time.
Right.
And you got to hold both those if you want to take advantage. Because if you only have the fine-tooth comb, most of us can't face ourselves that deeply. But if you only have the big picture, you'll never make any change in your life. And that's what really matters.
Right.
Such an important combo.
Right. And I would say what you just said slightly differently, which is like, if I'm so concerned about voting on the 17th of September, then I have another vote, you know, which is the thumbs up, thumbs down of God for me personally, us personally, and also as our nation. And I'm just like, okay, we have something bigger here. Another parenthesis is that the folks at Shas, the Sephardic party, the Sephardi Haredi party, has once again...
They're the best with the slogans.
I mean, I hear on your podcast, The Jewish Story, you know, talking about sometimes, you know, separation of church and state as an issue. I mean, these guys are like, there is no separation between church and state. Vote for us is the right vote for Yom HaDin, for the Day of Judgment.
Yeah, ten tshuva b'kalpi.
Right, ten tshuva, do repentance.
It's got two meanings.
Right.
Put an answer into the ballot box
and
repent by putting that answer into the ballot box. It's brilliant.
Or they have another slogan, which is related, which is a petak shelcha l'Yom HaDin.
Yes, that one I saw too.
Your vote.
Your slip.
Your slip. You know,
but then also in Jewish tradition, it's the
Pitka, the Pitka Tova.
Pitka the top. I can't even think of the word in English. Your judgment, basically.
Right. And they just mix those things. And then they have a Sephardic song. You know, I think it's El Nora Lila. El Nora Lila. And they play that. There was a video. And it's like this people doing tshuva, and they're also voting for Shas.
It's part of the process.
You know what? In a sense, as coming from the...
But it's illegal now to give out water that has been blessed by a Kabbalist. Okay. Just remember that.
Okay.
They had to pass a law against
in the country. In the Muslim Arab tradition, the concept of separation of church and state, of Rome and God, Caesar and God, is not present.
Also in our root tradition,
right?
But we've been deeply westernized in that respect, and I think there are benefits to it.
You know, I was talking to somebody. I was talking with Jeremy Sultan, who said to me last week, we talked about the priests, the prophets, the king, priest, prophet, king,
and the courts.
And the courts, and the cops. Courts and the cops are the same. He's like, but there's another group that you missed.
What's that?
The elders.
How are they different than the courts?
I don't know. I don't think they're a court. I think they're the folks that... I mean, I don't think they're just a court. They're the folks who come out at the end of the town. They're the town leadership. They're the wise men. They're the... I don't think it's the same as a court.
It is in the rabbinic mind.
When they said right, but an elders is also like a
council of elders,
a council which is not just a court. A court comes to decide, has to have a case in controversy.
Okay, but I think that's again a bit of a misapplication of political theory. The Torah's notion of a court is a quasi legislative institution.
Right.
It's not just jurisdiction.
Right.
Always has been.
Okay,
but okay, I get the point.
Okay, but you know, no, even what you said now, that's fine. Even that's clarifies it for us. That there is not only the court as in a...
adjudicating somebody else's laws.
Right. These guys are coming out and they're making policy for the town or
they're
for the place.
Actually leading.
Right. Anyway, okay, so there's a lot of stuff. So the maelstrom is spinning again.
And the kids are back in school.
The kids are back to school.
How many parent meetings have you gone to this week?
I have not gone to one, but my wife has, and I've stayed home watching the kids. But what I sometimes call babysitting, what my wife calls parenting, okay? It's a little joke that we had there. We have in our house. And there is one more thing, which is spinning the whole thing. What's like the kids are back to school, it's winter is coming, war is like constantly mini looming elections.
I find the fact that the continental plate is splitting in the Jordan Valley to be quite disturbing on a certain scale, but we can leave that out of it.
Anyway, the point is that the situation is definitely volatile, but also awesome.
Well, I mean. I wouldn't want to live in boring times.
Right. It's just, there's an awesomeness. There's an awesomeness to it all. If you can get above the fray.
You have to. That's what I meant. You have to be in the fray for it to matter. Right. But you have to be above the fray to actually maintain some sense of hopefulness and sanctity.
And sanity.
And sanity.
And I personally, I think that for listeners of the show, the great island of sanity and truth in a world of a postmodern world of many truths.
Total constructs.
Right. Like, there's a beauty and an island of sanity and clarity in the Torah.
Yes.
In having the Torah. And the Torah portion of the week is an awesome, awesome anchor of sanity.
It's packed with so much.
Right. And this Torah portion has the most amount of commandments in the whole Torah. There's basically three Torah portions, which are
Mishpatim.
Mishpatim. Shoftim also, uh-huh, that we just had. Ki Teitze. And I think also, what do you call it? Acharim HaKadoshim.
Yes.
These are the basics of where the Talmud comes into play. So we have a very long Torah portion with many sections. As in our custom for the last few weeks, we shall only talk about a few topics that I picked out.
Such is our custom.
Such is our custom. And the first one is, you go to war. Okay, so we're in the book of Deuteronomy, book of Dvarim. This is now the speech, the part of the speech of Moses, which is called the Ne'um HaMitzvot, the commandment speech. Okay, it's shifted from narrative and storytelling to...
It's like that moment in Shul where you see everybody start to nod off.
That's right.
When the rabbi gets into the gritty.
That's right, that's right. And so we have a lot of law, and we're in chapter 21, verse 10, and the Torah portion is going to speak about something possibly unpleasant, I'm sure, to some of your students here at Pardes, hard to swallow, which is the woman of beautiful appearance, which you see during a time of war.
The war wife.
The war wife, the war woman, and you either cohabit with her right there and then, the soldier, or takes her back home, right? And the law says... She's got to either cut her nails or not cut her nails, but in any case, she's got to kind of take off her. She's got to wear these clothes of.
She's not attractive any longer.
She's in some way she's not
clothes of mourning and
she's got to cry for her parents.
Right, she's navelet. She like literally just doesn't look so good.
Right, she doesn't look so good. She's not. It's not the heat of war in that kind of moment. And the Torah says, okay, but here's how to. Here's how you have to deal with this woman. And it kind of gives you a type of out to do this act, which is ostensibly not very beautiful.
Morally reprehensible.
Right, very morally challenging, at least.
So I got to tell you, I witnessed one of my colleagues giving a class on this the other day, and I have to say I was deeply disappointed with the apologetics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, because you already noted that even amongst the classical commentators, it's not clear when it says, or you go out to war against your enemies, and you win, and you see this beautiful woman, and you take her. It's not clear if that means you take her captive and you have to wait a month and marry her properly, or actually no, as unfortunately still happens in war, that there's an immediate sort of sexual interaction that happens there. And he denied strenuously the second one and said it was the first, except the reality is the Rambam says very clear, mm-hmm, that both are part of this process.
Right.
And what's to me unfortunate, I mean, I understand why he did it, because you are correct that for my students, this is fairly hard to swallow. Not that it happens. It's hard to swallow that the Torah would institutionalize it in their eyes.
Right.
But it's a deep misunderstanding.
But the sages themselves admit or discuss that this is a tough thing.
But not only that, but Rashi brings what to me is the most important insight. Right? Because before I get to what it is, we have to remember that the Torah, like all sort of elements of revelation, has a dilemma, so to speak.
Right.
Revelation
That's
is
what
by
I meant.
Definition.
Dilemma, I like that, yeah.
Parochial, meaning it happened to specific people at a specific time in a specific place. Otherwise, it's not real, right? Sinai is a real place. The people who came out of Egypt were real people, which means they spoke a language, they had a cultural context, meaning for the infinite will to be understood, it had to come in a very specific form.
Mm-hmm.
But God's will was forever, mm-hmm, which means it's as relevant to you and I here at the latter part of the sixth millennia or 21st century, whenever you think you are, right, as it was 3,000 plus years ago. So how does that work? And this actually is one of the great revelations of how it works. Because in the world 3,300 years ago, the idea that you couldn't just take a woman in battle, do your will with her, and then sell her into slavery was a huge moral leap forward. The fact that the Torah says you cannot sell her into slavery at the end of it, you've now done her wrong, so to speak, and you are responsible for a proper marriage, which in the ancient world meant you are financially responsible.
Just in parentheses, like, people rape, then kill.
Yes. Or then sell into slavery, right. Which is more profitable.
Right.
You know? But my point is that the Torah takes this moral stand, and even there, the sages are bothered, like you point out, because it's like, we have a higher expectation of behavior. So Rashi brings their deepest insight. It says, Lo dabar Torah ela keneged yetzer hara. The Torah is only speaking against the evil inclination in man. So my students will still protest to me. It's like, what do you mean? The Torah is like just saying, okay, well, let him do it because he can't help himself. I say, no. What I've said to them before is that the Torah is trying to train us away from that. You can't just flip a switch and change a human being, right, or human culture.
Right.
And I actually had quite a fierce discussion with a student on this once. And finally, at the end, I said to her, I just want you to know that your deep opposition to this is the greatest victory that the Torah could have. Because it created a culture that would bring about someone like you who is so not only offended personally, but morally opposed to this act, that you will deny the Torah itself in order to defend the ultimate value that it's communicating. You know, and that's the brilliance of the divine will within,
right,
the Torah.
Right.
And it causes a cultural evolution,
mm-hmm,
which is why I think it's important not to shy away from the pshat, from the simple meaning of what's happening here.
Very good. Very good. Although one commentator who did shy away from the meaning, or didn't shy, but took it to a totally different place, I mention every year, I'll mention it again, which is the Or HaChaim, and he says something completely fascinating different. He says, listen, a Jewish soldier is super holy. And he comes into a place of war, and he's slaying the bad guys, and he's taking what's ours, and he's pushing back the people who want to destroy us, etc. And he walks into a house, and he sees a woman. He sees in her a Jewish soul. He sees in her that she's somehow captive of the Yetzer Hara. And he's like, I'm going to go through a process of bringing you into our nation because I see something in you. And if you think about that, that also is a culture war. I mean, say we have a lot of culture that we have to fight against. We have to slash and burn it. We have to put up walls, or I don't know what, to push it away. But sometimes there's a thing.
Yes.
And that thing has to be brought in. And even that thing needs to go through a process,
yes,
of koshering, if you will.
Yeah, this is what Rav Kook calls Gyur HaRayanot. It's a conversion of ideas. It's very interesting. I wonder if his thought is rooted in the Or HaChaim. I have to try to trace that
down.
That's
an interesting thought. Okay. For the sake of time, we have to go on because we really do have a lot. So we dealt now with the Isha Yafat Tor. And let me see where my next note is. Okay, here we go. Okay. Now I jumped all the way to chapter 21, verse 22, which is about a person who commits some kind of capital offense and then gets hung up on a tree, gets hanged. It's important to know that in Jewish law, we're not talking about hanging like by the neck. We're talking about killing a person and then displaying him on a tree.
Right.
Now, what the law is, not what the custom was to do it right at the end of the day. Put him up on the tree for a minute or two, for a little bit, for a short period of time, and then take him down. Because what the Torah says, you're not allowed to leave him hanging there. You're not allowed to leave him on the tree. You have to take it down and bury him properly.
Kilalat Elohim talui.
Right.
It's a curse to God when someone is hung up like that.
Right.
You know, and it goes to the heart of the tension, again, that the Torah is holding. On one hand, this person did something worthy of death.
Right.
So, like, hey, let's not only stone him, let's drag his body through the streets, I don't know, behind a motorcycle or something.
Right. Like,
But on the other hand, as Rashi once again brings the Midrash, what does it mean, kilalat Elohim talui? It's a curse to God that he's hung. Well, because it's like two twins that are born. One becomes the king, and the other one becomes a bandit. When the bandit gets caught and hung, everybody looks at him saying, hey, look, they hung the king. So the king obviously is God. And humanity created in the image of God, meaning don't forget, every time we do something wrong, it's actually two things wrong. It's whatever we've done, and it's disgrace to the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, so we minimize that disgrace by saying, yeah, he did it. Don't forget.
We got to show the punishment, but then we still have to honor
the divine within this human being.
Right, that's right.
Right? And it is all but impossible. It is possible, unfortunately, I think, but all but impossible to destroy the Tzelem Elohim within a human being, to destroy the divine image.
Mm-hmm.
I unfortunately do have a suspicion that it's possible.
Mm-hmm. A little humorous but homiletic here, which is
Kikilat. That's your next book, humorous, right, but homiletic.
Yeah, Kikilat Elokim Talui Tolui means, it could be like this, it could be like this in modern Hebrew, right?
It means depends.
Depends,
which
right?
is the same in English. Something right. could be one way or the other or hanging.
Right. Well, sometimes living on the edge of being like, well, it could be like this, it could be like this, it could be like this, it could be like this. When you don't have clarity, that's a curse.
Oh, for sure.
And that's why we say, Ein simcha el hatarat zvekot. Okay. So here, the opposite of that is kilat elokim talui.
Right. It's a curse to be hung.
To be like always like, well, you know, you got to come down. You got to come down.
On the other hand.
Right. On the other hand. And you learn that in law school, and sometimes you actually start to be able to really be good at arguing the other side, but you forget what truth is because you're so good at seeing both sides or
listen, at the risk of generalizing all Jewish history, that's one of the problems of the overdevelopment of the rabbinic mind. It's one of the reasons that the Zionists were so enamored of the Tanakh and not so fond of rabbinic culture.
Right. That's right. Sometimes you just got to come down and be decisive. A lot of times people say to me, well, don't the Palestinians, can't they argue the same thing? I go, I don't know. I'm not their advocate. I just say to people, like, I remind people, I'm like, let me, maybe you don't know my role. I'm the advocate for my people.
Right.
And something that it's a Russian thing that my mom said to me that her father said to her, like, you've got to be your own advocate. I'm like, I'm not the advocate for, I'm not finding the logical flaw in my thing or the logical similarity to their case. I'm not there for that. I'm here to be an advocate for my people. And I think that that's Kilat Elokim Tolui. Okay, fine. Let's go to the next one.
Ding.
Yes, I marked for myself here a verse, again, chapter 22, verse 3, which basically says that if you find an artifact.
The donkey, perhaps.
A lost donkey, and we actually have a case of that in the book of Samuel. The lost donkey, you have to return it. You have to look for the owner. You have to house it, and the Gemara is going to go through many of the laws of how much you're supposed to expend in order to house this. But basically for his garment and for all the things that are lost for your brother, don't look away. Lo tucha lehit alim.
That's the key.
Right. You can't look away. And we all know, by the way, that sometimes we look away. And Rashi says here that look away means, where is it? Lichbosh la'alim einecha ki'ilu encha ro'eoto. Like, look away and make it look like I didn't see it.
Oh, sorry. I would have, but I didn't notice.
But you know, you walk past somebody who's asking for money.
For sure.
And you just act like you didn't see them. You don't necessarily give them an excuse.
Yep.
Just make yourself as though you didn't see it. Don't do that.
I think that this area of law, which is called Hashavat Avedah, the returning of lost objects, is actually one of the most profound sort of, we'll call it, social organizing principles in the entire Torah. Because if you could succeed, and sadly we have not, if you could succeed in instilling this in the same way in religious Jewry as we've instilled laws of Kashrut, laws of Shabbat, etc., that you have now, don't misunderstand me, this it has a deep expression. I mean, one of the characteristics of religious neighborhoods is you walk around, you see little signs up, you know, found lost keys, found, you know, this. I'm not saying that it's not done, but my point is that there's a much deeper engagement. For instance, if you look in the extension of these laws, if I walk by someone's house and I see that, I don't know, a faucet on the outside of their house is on and the water's gushing out, it's my Torah level responsibility to turn that off as long as I don't assume it was intentional. Why? Even if no damage is done, I have to preempt the damage being done. I mean, there's a level of mutual responsibility.
Right.
Right, and the flip side is what Rashi said, is that it fights against one of the deepest elements of social psychology, which is to draw very tight boundaries of responsibility. And the way we do that is by convincing ourselves that we just don't see.
Another one of a field that maybe is a derivative of this is the derivative of Kinyan Ruchani, they call it in Hebrew, which is intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectual property gets lost all the time.
Oh, yeah.
People read it, they re-say it, media, they will redo it and take your ideas. And I think that intellectual property, not losing other people's intellectual property, again, brings ge'ulah to the world. When you say something in somebody's name, it's like I am actually not losing that person's master. This idea came from something. It was developed as something, and you give it the credit. And when you give it the credit, there's something that happens there, and people respect you so much more when you're a person who can quote somebody else and say, "I spoke to this person. He said this thing." you know, it's my mom or my daughter. It doesn't matter, you know. A lot of times when I'm writing an article, I feel bad. I tell my mom, I'm like, I would love to write you in here. I don't know what to say. Should I say in parentheses, my mom told me? I don't know what to say. It's a tricky thing, you know, yeah. Because but like it's a serious business, I think, intellectual property.
It is, although what's interesting is that in the halachic discourse, in the legal discourse, it's actually there's something called zuto shel yam in these laws, which is that if I lose something in somewhere where it's just gone, by definition, it gets swept away. So then I have no ownership of it, even if I find it again. And it's one of the sources of the whole discourse around intellectual property. If I put something out on the internet, there's an argument to be made that when I put it out there, I know for a fact it's just gone.
So that's only because we believe that people will not give you credit. It doesn't have to be gone because it's actually the most traceable in the world.
No, but my point is it's just I think that morally your point is well taken. And certainly, right, as you said, that a person who says something in the name of the person who said it brings redemption to the world. But legally, halachically, it's actually the internet that pushes us toward a notion of a lack of ability to exercise property, intellectual property rights.
Okay. That's an interesting question. But still, we can all each take upon ourselves that effort. For example, if you heard something on this show, you know, say I heard it in the name of. Speaking of, if you heard this show, please rate, do a little thing and rate these shows of our network highly on whatever you're listening to. I know that that we try very hard to get it out on Stitcher, iTunes, and all the other, you know, all the other podcast aggregators out there. So it's very, very important. It's a lot of hard work, and it's really done with a lot of love. So give us the love right back if you can. That would be intellectually awesome if you would just
like me.
Yeah, like me, and then help other people like more. That's the way you help today.
That's true, by
leaving a good review. Let's go to two laws here. And one is about the sending away the mother bird, shooing away the mother bird. This is a very famous law. My son just came back from Chabad. He gets like one day a week. He goes to like Chabad stuff with Rabbi Shloimi in Efrat. And guess what? He came back with a little picture of a bird kind of being sent away with real feathers and stuff. Neat stuff. And the basic law is very simple. If you're going to walk on the path, or you're going to get some eggs or some chicks for yourself, you have to shoo away the mother bird before you take those things. Now, there's a few different ways of reading it. Either it's for psychological health for this mother that she doesn't see her chicks being taken away. Another read is actually completely different. It has nothing to do with the psychological health. It's meaning to say, do not take the mother bird along with these things, with the eggs or the chicks, meaning to say, allow for another generation to flourish.
The sustainability perspective.
Sustainability, right? Like the whole point is not that she doesn't see. That's not the issue. Do not take her with.
Right.
Okay. And that's what my mom says. My mom says that that here, when it says that you'll have long days from doing this mitzvah, that you'll be blessed with l'man yitavlach v'arachta yamim, that you'll be good for you and you shall have long days. She's like, it's because of sustainability. What's the word?
An intergenerational perspective.
Reusable energy.
It's renewable resource.
Renewable resource there. So that's two. What do you have to add about that?
I mean, if you wanted to go for a third instead of going back to those, I think there's also, and this one comes up in an argument between the Rambam and the Ramban, there's a psycho-emotional effect on me that forget the bird and how she feels about taking the eggs. I associate that bird with motherhood.
Right.
And so therefore the act of cruelty of saying, I'm going to take for me what I want and you too, right? It doesn't train me toward a sensitivity to the world.
Right.
That's a third piece, although it's an edgy one because not everybody likes that.
I think that people understand that naturally.
I know, but this is an argument of the Rambam and the Ramban.
Yeah, no, I think I can understand that. Okay, here though I must tell you that within this verse lies one of the great joys that I've ever had in my life in terms of Torah learning.
Really?
And yes, it lies really within this very verse. And what happened was like this: when I was in Aliyah, I think I told you this last year. When I was in Aliyah activism, still am in Aliyah activism, but when I was really, really active in Aliyah propagation,
when you were a young whippersnapper,
right? So I was like, this verse explains how to work in this field, because what it says is the parents
I got it.
are holding the kids back. you have to shoo away the parents
and steal their children
and take the children towards your side. Of course, by the way, v'heishuv levavot al banim. Like in
right,
the
ultimately,
end, the parents will follow
because the grandkids
doesn't mean it just means shoo away the mother bird and yeah. show the kids because the mother bird in America is like, you can't go to Israel. It's dangerous. I don't want to leave you. Blah 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 blah. You have to sometimes somehow detach that and bring in this next generation. But what happened was is that when I thought this thought, I thought to myself, boy, that's kind of blasphemous, or you know, that is not the meaning of the verse. And if I teach that to people, I'll get in a lot of trouble. So I have to keep my mouth shut on it. What happened was subsequently is that I found this explained in the Baalei Torah, and I should have brought the original text. The word teshalach is also the word teshalach here. It's not in the Baalei Torah here. It's in the other matching word, which is in the Song of the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Teshalach ruchacha yivron, right? Like you'll send your wind. In any case, so it says there. What did God do? He wanted to bring his children into the land of Israel, but the generation of the Exodus was holding them back. So he had them die in the desert so he can bring in his. And that's what and the Baalei Torah says, exactly like this verse about the mother bird. He shooed away the mother bird and brought his children into the land of Israel.
And then it's not you, it's the Baalei Torah.
But do you understand that the meaning of the verse was exactly the same? It was exactly on, which is on the issue of Aliyah, mm-hmm. which is that the parents were holding it back, yep. and he had to bring in the next generation. So I was like, wow, that was a joyous moment in my life.
Listen, this is a profound challenge we face, even for those of us that are here. There's still a certain mentality which is holding us back from acting as right. a people in our land.
Right. You know, you said it exactly, which is the misread of what I said is don't listen to parents and take the young people. Like in the 60s, don't right. listen to anybody over 30. That right. is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there are things that hold us back. We all have our own mother bird.
Mm-hmm.
We all have our own mother bird that we have to shoo away yeah. in order to reach our potential.
Yes, absolutely.
We have to shoo something that's holding us back, a fear.
And not always just fear. Sometimes it's just simply an incorrect understanding of a situation which came to us from the past. One of the great rules of history is yesterday's solutions are tomorrow's problems, right? And if we get overly wedded to the particular solution as opposed to our ability to engage the situation as it is and come up with some sort of answer, then oftentimes we get stuck. And the very thing that saved us can be that which drags us down.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the great challenges.
How do you spell shoo away? How is that spelled? Is that S-H-O-O? What is that?
I don't have to look it up.
That's a Malka question. Maybe the show's name should be Shoo Away Fear. Shoo Away the Fear. Shoo Away the Fear. All right, maybe. Okay.
Yeah, but we definitely want to spell it correctly.
Then we definitely will. Not like shoe, like a shoe. Okay. We have a shoe in this week's Torah portion. I don't think we're going to get to that one, which is the levirate marriage and the taking of the chalitza.
That was an insider joke. Anyway.
Yes, that's right. Shoo away, right? Okay. Okay, the other one, actually, the next verse that I wanted to discuss is right next to it, which is about the roof. You build a house, you've got to put a, there's a fancy word for it. There's a fancy
fence.
Parapet? Parapet, is
well,
that
parapet
the
is more of like, you know, it has to do with certain fortifications
okay.
on top of a castle.
Okay, you've got to put a fence.
Call it a fence.
You've got to put a fence. Around now, the houses were and continue to be here in the Middle East with flat roofs. The Talmud talks a lot about a sukkah on the roof.
Yep.
Okay, we're not talking about like fiddler on the roof here. We're talking about sukkah on the roof. We're talking about a flat roof.
Yeah, because around here, fiddler on the roof makes perfect sense.
What do you mean?
Well, meaning the whole point of that Tevye story is that to be a Jew in Europe was like being a fiddler on a roof.
Right.
You can't really, you're going to wear a move, you're going to fall off.
Right.
But actually, it makes sense to be a fiddler on a roof in the Middle East because it's flat. It's a perfect
That's
place
right.
for
it's
a
It's much better to be a fiddler
you're
on
at
a
home,
roof here. There you
and
go.
There's a deep message there.
The thing I wanted to stop on this verse was that it says you have to put away, you have to put this fence around the roof because the faller shall fall from it.
Yeah.
The faller shall fall from it. Meaning to say, on the simple level, it means a person could fall.
Right. The guy who's going to fall will fall.
He'll fall. If you're not careful, they'll be falling.
Right.
It's not really not so tricky.
No, it is a strange syntax.
The syntax is strange, and that's why Rashi says this guy was supposed to fall. He deserved to fall for one reason or another.
I mean, elsewhere, the implication is we see in a discussion elsewhere that he might have been someone who should have been punished by death for murder,
right.
but there were no witnesses to do so properly. So he's basically got a spiritual debt, which is God is collecting.
Right.
You know, by causing him to fall. But right. Well, your point but lies in the other half.
It doesn't
half.
Have to be on my roof.
Right. Doesn't have to be on my watch.
Right. Not my watch. Not over my, not in my, through me. Meaning to say, if the Rashi says this very, very famous phrase, which is, it says, "Megalgalin zchut al yedei zakai vechova al yedei chayav." A person who's got merits, meritorious things happen to him.
What happens through him?
Through him.
Al yedei.
Through him. That's right. And a person who has debts, and that's what chova means. A person right. that is a debtor, a spiritual debtor. Well, the debt's taken through him.
And it's interesting because one could read that.
You could just say, here in the Middle East, you could say it's maktub. Yeah. It's written. He was supposed to fall.
Ah, that's exactly what I was going to speak against. He was supposed to fall, and you could read it as a fatalism.
Right.
Listen, if you have merits, meritorious things come into the world through you. If you've got debts, bad things come into the world through you. But the whole point of this is that you're being called to do a mitzvah. Meaning, we don't believe in a fatalistic world in which what I've done in the past dictates what will happen to me in the present, because I can always do the mitzvah. Right. What if I am a chov person, I have debts, and there's some guy who's meant to die who's on my roof, but I did the mitzvah. You know what the answer is? So even though I have debts and he's meant to die, it won't happen through me. Why? Because mm-hmm. the power that comes to doing mitzvah is the ability to break the cycle of fatalism. I can always change my destiny through both the belief and the actions that the Torah dictates. So you understand the distinction there?
Sure.
So it's a very important one in this story.
And he also, that if you buy the time, meaning so he goes on your roof and there's a fence and he looks down and everything's fine, he doesn't fall. Maybe he'll do tshuva.
Yeah.
Maybe there'll be another way to pay that debt. Maybe he won't have to fall off that roof.
It's very true. And I want to add just as a...
You come into my house, it's a holy house. It's got the mitzvot. Maybe he is going to also see my library. Maybe he's going to ask me to put on tefillin. Maybe he's going to come to a different place.
Just think of it simply. Like, the guy's up on the roof. He stumbles. He has his life flashes before his eyes. And suddenly this sort of like chest-high fence catches him. He's like, and there he is. He's looking at what could have been.
Right.
And that's just because I said, of course there's a fence on my roof. That's right. What the Torah says to do.
That's right.
And by the way, lest people think that this is just a thing in the Torah, you look around in Israel and it is a reality. Unfortunately, not everywhere. We actually had the Arab man who was the janitor here for many years at Pardes died from falling off his roof because where...
Which one?
Which one what?
Which janitor? The guy that was here always?
Well, I mean, he hasn't been here for about a year and a half. He passed away.
From this fall?
From falling off his roof, which did not have a fence around it.
Gewalt.
Yeah.
I did not know that. I was wondering where he was. There was a different guy here today. And yes. I was like, where's that other guy?
Yeah. So no, not the one you're thinking of. Okay. It's been a year and a half since Hussein passed
away.
But
Arabs don't, by the way, Arabs have flat roofs. And often there is no fence around.
There's certainly
the roof.
No commandment in their tradition to have one.
Right. Okay. Very good. Let's go on. Here's one that you probably wouldn't guess that I wanted to stop on.
And nothing surprised me.
Okay. And that is, it says... certain people that have injuries are not part of Kahal Hashem, but the only reason they're not part of the congregation, and the only reason I'm stopping here is because there's a word called patsua daka. What is a patsua daka exactly? It's a moom. It's some kind of
injury or right, sort of genetic imperfection
involving the testicles.
Yes.
The only reason I'm stopping here is that in the Chabad Lubavitch day reading, they have this like day lessons, there was a discussion about this word daka, which the Alter Rebbe saw, I think, in the Torah of the Maharami Rutenberg, written with an aleph. And he says, lehalacha, in his opinion, it should be written with an aleph. And it was in another place as well. And we write it with a hey. And that's it. Meaning to say, we have a Torah, it is perfect. It is God's word, and we have it across. But the Alter Rebbe was like, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe was like, I actually believe that this should be an aleph, and not a hey. And these little, it's like for some people that change is like, whoa.
It fundamentally undermines what they mean by perfect.
Right, and yet the Torah is, it's not a science, it's an art, you know.
That's an important distinction, and I want to rest with it for 1 second, because when we say perfect, we mean perfect in God's conception. right? Its manifest form is always subject to not only human error, but also human expression. And that's what the whole endeavor of the oral Torah is. You know, in this case, this particular type of injury, and from a technical perspective, can also be caused by a testicular biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
You know why people would have a testicular biopsy? Right? Sometimes to try to identify the causes of male infertility.
Mm-hmm.
So Rav Moshe Feinstein, in the mid to late, I think it was later part of the 20th century, she made a judgment that it can't be that this is something which is a cause for someone not to be married. That's what the mm-hmm. Torah says. If the reason they're doing it is in order to have children to fulfill a mitzvah. Mm-hmm. So he said, Nishtanu ativayim, that the world has changed to the point that if what you're doing is not only not causing a person to be infertile, but is actually a way in which to determine how to make them fertile, even though technically it's the same thing, ultimately it is not.
Mm-hmm.
This is another great example that he was able in his wisdom to see what the divine intention was and not change a letter or a word in the Torah,
mm-hmm.
but to change the way in which it plays out in our lives.
And I like, just as a kind of submission, maybe there's a difference between hay and aleph, meaning to say maybe in our time we need an aleph as opposed to a hay
for that
change to take place.
Could be.
And I just thought that was really cool. And I saw it, and I was like, wow, you know, and I think people, especially Balei Tshuva that come into Torah, they have this conception that it's rigid. And Rabbi Tendler once told us such a beautiful thing. He's like, halacha is a box. Within the box, you can move. And then there's outside of the box. That's something different.
Sure.
But there, you've got to have wiggle room. And there's wiggle room in Judaism for 12 tribes that walk in 12 paths.
Sure.
For a shin that either has three lines or four. Or for commandments that are either 613 or at least 612, okay? And that wiggle room is key, and it also allows for perspective. It allows for another way of understanding something.
I'll tell you, to me, most importantly, what it allows for is life. The halacha is an organic endeavor. It's alive. It's growing.
Right.
It's not some abstract philosophical pursuit that's trying to nail things down into sort of like a cold perfection.
That's not the way we roll. Let's keep going.
It's just messy, but it's effective.
That's right. Let's keep going just because of time interests. One of my favorite Torah commandments is you got to have a holy army camp. Now, if you have ever been to an army camp, it's generally not so holy for many reasons. And yet it says, guess what? If you're going to have an army camp, I want you to have a special place where you go to the bathroom.
Not okay. Just a special place, but a special tool with which to do
right.
it.
Right. So it's got two sides. First, it's yad. Yad is a place. A place should be with for you outside of the camp. And that's where you got to go poopy. You got to go out there. Okay, fine. Not only that, you have to have on your other vessels that you carry with you, on your stuff, the things they carried, if anybody read that, you got to have along that a...
trowel.
A trowel. A trowel. Which is a little shovel, folks. Okay. Listen carefully because I've shown this to my kids and it's made a big impact on them. It says, dig, and then you should sit and do your thing, and then you should cover the thing that came out of you. This is very important. I know since you're of your
I was just like, the amount of memories I have of teaching like well-off suburban kids, how do you actually deal with going to the bathroom in the real world where there's not, you know, sort of like plush toilet paper and a heated seat. I mean, I've literally dozens and dozens.
Right.
It's, yeah.
But there's nothing more clean and beautiful than when you finish your doing your business and you cover it up and it's more or less the way nature was and it goes back into the earth in a normal way. And there's nothing more foul than going out to nature.
Coming across someone's mess.
Right, someone's mess with the flying toilet paper and the mess and your flies. And you're like, what did you do? Didn't you know that, first thing, didn't you like have plain manners? And then two, didn't you ever have a Mike Ford to teach you what to do?
Well, the answer is most people don't.
Right. Now, what I do in the Army with this is I say to them, hey, some guy's like, hey, you guys have toilet paper? You give them toilet. I'm like, do you need a shovel, buddy? He's like, what? I'm like, I got a shovel because I was very makbid to take a shovel to take this shovel to the army. And I'm like, it's in the Torah. They're like, no, it's not.
What are you talking about?
And I would show them this verse and they would always be like, it says this in the Torah? And yeah. I'm like, yes.
It's very important.
Right. This is what it says in Torah. And look how clean and simple it is.
And specific.
Specific.
It's process.
Right. And as another mistake could be just to cover it over.
No, you got to dig first.
Dig down. Make a hole. Cover it over. Come back to nature as much as possible.
Yeah.
After you do your thing. And it's beautiful. and it's clean. And if you didn't do it, it's not as clean. I just want to say that it says at the verse 15, chapter 23, verse 15, it says, Ki Hashem Elokecha mitalech, Hashem your God is walking amongst you, bekerv machanecha, in your camp, to protect you, to defend, to save you, and to give your enemies from before you. And therefore, v'haya machanecha kadosh, your camp has to be holy. This word mitalech appears only one other time in the Torah, and that is in the Garden of Eden, because the Spirit of God walks in the Garden of Eden. So you got the Garden of Eden, and then you have this army camp. They are on first blush.
It's as far apart as you get.
Right. No, God is with you. He's walking with you in your camp. In this world, you're at war. Next world, you'll visit the Garden of Eden. Here, we're at war, and that's where God is with you. And that's in this place is where I want you to stay holy.
Yeah.
And I do wish a lot of times that our Israeli army would have more of that consciousness.
Yes.
I really do. I mean, that's what moral army is to me. Not being nice to the bad guys, but pooping in the right place.
Well, you know? understanding that
keeping our mouths pure in the army, which is a big problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the bottom line notion is understanding that our physical actions are the beginning of holiness. And holiness isn't some abstraction of ideas or rituals. And this is why it begins with what is really the most physical of actions.
Right. And God is there with you.
Oh,
he's walking with you.
Late ata pnui mine klau. There's nowhere where God isn't.
Right.
Except for the places where you drive God right. out.
Interesting, you have to know that there is a place where we don't put a mezuzah, which is the bathroom, right?
That's different. I mean, meaning that's because of the sanctity that we place in our experience of the cloth, of the mezuzah itself. But you know, it's actually a debate amongst the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, because Hasidim were very big on late Ata Panui Mina, and like there's nowhere which is okay. And their answer was always, the Mitnagdim was always, what about the bathroom?
Right. No, so the bathroom is that you don't, God's in the bathroom, but you honor him when you come out. I mean, so you made the blessing about it.
In your very silence and distancing your thoughts right. from God is what gives God presence. That's even right. though this place. It's a great Reb Zushin, Elimelech story about that.
Of course.
We'll save it for another time.
That's right. Famous story. Speaking of keeping your mouth clean also, this is verse 24, Motzas fatecha tishmor. Watch what you say. Watch what comes out of your mouth.
Yeah, well, not just watch what comes out of your mouth, meaning also keep your word.
Keep your word.
The context there is in making vows. You should make sure if you're going to let something out of your mouth, then you need to do it. The Torah discourages right. making vows because
right.
it's creating a potential stumbling block. But if you're going to promise, it's a do or die situation.
And I want to say for people, and I say this sometimes to people when I see that they're loose about this, try to know what you're talking about. If you don't know what you're talking about, don't speak vociferously and proudly about something you don't know. It shows your ignorance. Don't do that. If you're not sure, say, I'm not sure. Say, I think. Say, I've heard. But don't speak about it with certainty if you don't know. It makes you sound dumb. And instead, it's much wiser to keep your mouth, you know, more silence than talking, and especially about opinion formulation, which we're very we live in a society which allows a lot for that. Let's keep it a little bit, you know, and especially about governance and stuff like that. Until you really see how it operates and understand it, don't let the news media, you know,
feed you
right.
a worldview.
Right.
There's another thing here, which is this is one of the keystones to strengthening one's relationships, be it to their children, to their spouses, to their friends, or even to themselves, is make promises and keep them.
Right. That's right.
If you make promises and keep them, your relationship will always have a sound basis.
I'll give you another example, which is advice or recommendations. If somebody asks me about a person, I'm going to be as honest as possible about that. I am never going to... If I recommend, people know that I'm going to recommend. That means that I really... am invested in this recommendation, and if I don't know, I'm just going to say I don't know. And I've made that mistake one time with somebody who asked me what do I think about this girl that he was about to be married to, and I said, yeah, great, yeah, no, Gary. And you know, they got divorced later on, and I thought to myself, that wasn't my fault.
No, of course not.
But it was,
you felt like you weren't honest in that moment.
I wasn't honest, and I, it wasn't that I was dishonest. I didn't put in weight, gravitas to those words. Mm-hmm. And I should have said to him, I don't know. Or if I had some concern, I would say, look, here I have a concern. And I want to tell you a quick story about this. And that is that I was talking about a certain rabbi that I think is a very, very, very wise rabbi and a strong rabbi that I respect. And he is also kind of famous, and he also is opinionated, and some people don't like him. And I met, and I was in the town of this rabbi, and I met somebody, and I was talking to her, and I said to her, you know, I do like this rabbi of your town. And she said to me, well, I want to tell you a story about him. One time when I was getting married, my husband-to-be, we were about to sign a prenup, and we were just about to get married, and the husband returned the prenup marked out with red highlighter, red marks, and crossed out things, and little all kinds of stuff like that, and changes that he made because he was a lawyer. I brought it to the rabbi, and this was like 3 days before the wedding. The rabbi said, look, call off the wedding. That's my advice to you. Don't marry this guy. And this girl was like, Rabbi, are you nuts? You know, I can't do that. It's 3 days before the wedding. Yeah. And also, what kind of rabbi are you? You know, I love this guy. We love each other. You know, this. The rabbi's like, look, I'm telling you my opinion. Call off the wedding. And you could guess that she did not listen to him. And then later was embroiled in a horrific, awful divorce that took a very long time. Okay, with this person. So to me, is that this how did we get to this?
The advice you give it weight.
Right, like he
went for it.
He went for his truth. And I was like, wow, that's even more respect than I even knew about this rabbi. But it wasn't easy to say that, but his words were invested with truth, and he didn't just okay.
Ooh, right.
That's right. Lime is timid, and we got to keep going. How long do we have? Do we have 5 more minutes or what? Okay. I was just about to say there's a verse here, chapter 25, verse 4. Lo tachsom shor v'disho. Do not muzzle an ox when it's amongst the threshing. The threshing. And we use this very commonly in Israel, which is like if you're about to make kiddush on Shabbos, don't wait too long because all the kids are waiting. Everybody's waiting.
And we bad use this, idea,
right? And this also means like don't hold back a person in his natural place. Like be conscious of where the other person is. Mm-hmm. And maybe this also has something to do with a big question that we don't have time for right now, which is dressing modestly. Mm. And this is a big question that I actually am thinking about a lot, which is how much do I have to be concerned with what's in your head? Like, how much do I have to be concerned with your...
That is a big question.
With your proclivities.
Yeah, it's a big question.
If they're natural proclivities.
I would say, just because you brought it up, I think that the tide has turned on that in our time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only real justification for modesty is as an intrinsic value and not in terms of what happens to other people when they're in immodest environments. Because the reality is that we know enough now about human psychology and behavior that a person needs to claim ownership of their own inner life and their own actions. That being said, I think modesty has its own intrinsic value, whether it's modesty for the way a man acts, whether it's modesty for the way a woman acts. But I am actually not so fond of this impetus toward modesty being in a concern of how others will respond to me.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't seen me in shorts.
On the one hand, I hear you, but on the other hand, there are certain human. It bothers me when you see actresses, right? Certain actresses, obviously, or certain models who are part of their whole life thing is to attract,
yes,
and then also coming down very hard at being, you know,
objectified.
Objectified. It's like, wait a minute, come on, you were using that very proclivity.
That's a different discourse because that's the desire to have your cake and eat it too. What I'm speaking about is the very common way in which modesty is used to try to project the inner struggles of a man onto the way that a woman dresses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about on the streets. What you're speaking about is people who have created an industry of lust. Let's just call it what it is. Okay, right. You can't create an industry of lust and then sort of like deny your responsibility for what happens to people when they react to you. That I get. The problem with that is that I think that men have not worked hard enough to just own their own behavior on that front. Let's call it what it is.
It's true. And I agree with you. And I think there's a tension there. At the same time, we do have some kind of lizard brain that's the modern terminology for this.
Yeah, sure.
That has natural reactions, and there is a subtle interest in evoking a very not subtle interest in evoking those reactions.
Yeah, for sure.
And that is part of the. I mean, that's what I mean by cake. That's what you said, cake.
Yeah, it's part of the human condition.
Right, but if you're going to play on that, know that's what you're playing on.
Yes.
And our society is actually flooding us. And we talked about it a little bit last week.
The pornographic nature of our society.
Right. That's right.
For sure.
Right. And then so you're asking for two things at the same time.
Yeah.
Withstand mass amount of supernormal stimuli.
You're basically incitement.
Right. Incitement. If that's fair to talk about it that way. And then at the same time, you want to ask for super proper behavior.
Oh, it's definitely fair to talk about it that way. Not necessarily on the part of this individual or that individual, but there are industries whose purpose is to incite particularly men, but also women on different things. And then one of the problems is that it plays itself out in interpersonal relationships in very ugly ways.
Okay, this is a big topic. We're not going to get through all of it.
Sorry, couldn't resist.
No, it's very important, but very, very important. Maybe we should take some time to talk about it. Let's finish off with the last thing. I'm even skipping an important one, but let's go to the last verse that I want to discuss today, the last group of verses, which is about Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you. This is at the end of the Torah portion, Deuteronomy 25, chapter 25, verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you when you came out of Egypt. It happened to you on the way, or he cooled you off on the way. He struck at you and your rear, all the people that were fallen behind, and you were tired and you didn't have faith in God. And it will be when Hashem will let you defeat all of your enemies around in the land, which Hashem, your God, gives to you. Remember to erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. You shall not forget. This is the famous Zachor. We read this right before Purim every year. This is the famous chapter of remembrance. It's one of the six remembrances in the Torah that asks you to remember something. Amalek strikes at you. It's the anti-Israel. It's the doubt of mankind. It's the cooling off of a belief in God, of heat, of excitement in the service of God. And it also strikes at the folks who are the weakest, at the maybe the disbelievers, the unbelievers, maybe the people who have somehow fallen out of the camp.
Just disadvantaged as well. I mean, I've always related to this in our time as a sort of an inner struggle and an inner conceptual battle. But, you know, in my last episode on the reparations, I encountered some of the writings of Rav Soloveitchik, who said he believed that Amalek always has a physical manifestation in the world as another people, right? He specifically was applying it to the Germans, and he was opposed to taking any reparations money from Germany. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think, very important to note that all these elements of the anti-Israel and the those who strike on the weak, etc., like what everyone thinks metaphysically, it's not hard to trace the fact that they seem to manifest themselves within socio-political realities as well. And it raises a very difficult and important question for us as a people is, what's our responsibility in the face of manifest political and cultural evil? Right? Can we just circle the wagons and say we're okay? That's what I understand here is, once you can do that in your land, now you have a different level of responsibility, which is to fight evil in the world as a whole. Mm-hmm. It's not enough just to be safe and a normal people in your land. That's not your job.
And yet we have Nazi-like ideology in our land.
We're not even safe within our land.
Right. Even in the streets of Jerusalem, there are no-go zones of places that have deep Nazi ideology that the Israeli police, Israeli army can't get control of.
And one of the things I would point out is that they also parallels those places within us, where we let the weak and the disadvantaged just fall behind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where we don't have this level of commitment, not even to one another, much less the people who lie outside of our immediate camp. And so I see the two as coming together. But there's a parallel process of fighting that battle of evil in the world.
I just want to finish off the show by saying I think that there was a great moment of reckoning when I saw Prime Minister Netanyahu climb out of a German sub/U-boat. Okay, when Israel bought, I think, six German submarines to protect our oil fields in the Mediterranean here, and Prime Minister Netanyahu kind of climbed out of one of these ships. And if you know anything about the submarines, that was one of the greatest German weapons. They were always the best at it. They were always great makers of submarines. They have tremendous experience in it. World War One, not to mention World War Two, but a lot, and even already in World War One, they had these U-boats. And so I just want to say, when I saw that, I thought to myself, you know, the question
of a circle.
Yeah, it was a great irony. It was a great irony when German subs are in the service of the state of Israel. There was something ironic and amazing about that. In any case, Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want to thank you so much for covering with me the Torah portion of Ki Teitzeh. A lot of Torah here, a lot to learn both morally and legally, and it's a living Torah. It's a living Torah, and behind it is a ton of oral Torah, the Talmud, the Mishnah, and the law. It's these are all just chapter headings. And thanks so much for touching them with me.
Always a pleasure. Shabbat shalom.
God bless you, everybody. Stay tuned. Malka Fleischer's, of course, next. We thank Rabbi Mike Foyer. By the way, people can reach you at RavMike@thelandofisrael.com, and also your website, which is JewishStory.co. That's C-O. And also
on Facebook, Rav Mike Foyer.
That's right. And your other show, The Jewish Story, here at the network. And of course, my stuff. You know, you share pleasure. It's easy to find me. And there you go. More great stuff is on the way. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, and we'll be right back.
Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Benny Gantz.
Avigdor Lieberman.
Yair Lapid.
Betzalel Smotrich.
Moshe Feiglin.
What's going on behind the scenes as Israelis prepare to go to the polls on September 17th? Tune in to Inside Israel Today on the Land of Israel Network, on thelandofisrael.com, for all the action as it happens.
Shalom, everybody, and welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show. This part of the show broadcasting from Judea, and you are still part of the show wherever you are. We moved a little bit south towards Judea and Gush Etzion, and I'm joined by my beloved Malka Fleischer. Malka, shalom.
Shalom. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you.
For another nice week, here we are in the month of Elul, before the holiday of Rosh Hashanah. You know how I know it's winter, by the way, that winter's coming, Yishai? There's one sign in Israel.
Okay.
And if you're perceptive, you can tell exactly when the winter season starts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when the Crembo comes out in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tasty treat. It's called Crembo. It's a little biscuit. There's like a fluffy marshmallow top and then some chocolate on top of that. And it only comes out in the wintertime because it's melty. In the summertime, no Crembo. You cannot find it anywhere. And I've seen it, Isha. I've sighted the Crembos in the grocery store, which mm-hmm. means that the seasons are changing.
I appreciate the Crembo, but I find it to be too delicate. Too delicate, too given to being smushed. And also the white fudginess inside.
Fluffiness, really?
Fluffiness, yeah. Is too... It's too plasticky a little bit for me. It's a little. It's not my.
I understand. It's too like factory marshmallow.
Yeah. So I do recognize the greatness.
Yeah.
There's
even Crembo ice cream flavor.
Yeah. I don't know. Also, I'm getting to a point where things that taste too sweet are bothersome to me. I don't like too sweet. It's just like.
Well, Yishai, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I've looked through your genetic information. And it turns out that you are more inclined to like salty things statistically, whereas I am more inclined to like sweet things statistically. I don't know if you know that.
I didn't know that, but that's for example, that's not seems to be a little challenged by the fact that, for example, when it comes to blintzes,
yeah.
I prefer them sweet. You like them savory. Same with Pesach products like what do you call it, matzah brei.
Mm-hmm.
Or I like to call matzah bride. that's when you're like married to somebody who's going to make you matzah bride. You know, so matzah bride is what I prefer. And also, you're born close to Passover, so I think of you as my matzah bride. and I like it again sweet. You like it savory.
That's true.
And my genetic information revealed to you that I'm
predisposed. Yeah, I don't know if you know that I've looked through your genetic information. You told me actually that I was allowed to look through your genetic information. So it's not like I just went through genetic information.
No, I gave you permission because I couldn't figure it out anyway.
Because I made a decision. And the decision was that we were going to take one of those 23andMe DNA tests to find out all kinds of stuff about ourselves.
Right.
Really, it was because it was Prime Day on Amazon and I bought those kits 50% off. So usually they're $100 and I bought them for $50 so each of us could have a kit. And I've been saving this kit. For a long time, I made you schlep it back from one of your trips to America.
Yeah.
And I made you schlep it back in your luggage. And it's been sitting on a shelf for a long time. And I'm a little bit, how do you say, neurotic, right? And so I was like grappling with this idea. Do I want to take a DNA test? Do I not want to take a DNA
where
test?
Where does the neurosis
what does
show
it mean?
Up in this?
And then ultimately, I looked at the boxes and
the
I saw that the... What?
What neurosis is
well,
associated
the neurosis
with
is that... Well, there's a few neuroses. One is like neurosis. Yeah. One is like an old school Eastern European fear that someone's going to have my medical information. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's an American fear. I'm not sure which kind of fear that is.
I'm just afraid there's going to be more like me. People will be like, now we can clone you.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. No, I never worry that someone wants to clone me. I more think like, oh, now they know too much about me. Oh. So that's number one. Number two. Okay. This is sensitive. So here we go. I don't want to be disparaging of anyone. Okay.
This is safe space. All of our listeners are in safe space.
Growing up, the more like Jewishy side of my family was always my father's side. They're Holocaust survivors. They would tell me stories about their religious parents. And I just always like felt the Jewishiness from my father's side. On my mother's side, I knew everyone's Jewish, right? And because I like being Jewish and want to be Jewish, and I like that I was born Jewish as well. So I like on my mother's side, so they're Jewish, right? And everyone had a Hebrew name and everything like that. But they were very like modern American, not so like mitzvah keeping Jews. And I think inside my head, I always had this fear that like, what if I'm not actually Jewish? It's like, I don't know. Does anyone else have that out there? Do you guys know what I'm talking about? The like the secret fear that like maybe I'm not actually Jewish. Maybe I'm non-Jewish. And then not that that's, I mean, you know, that's cool too. But like I've been raised my whole life believing that I'm Jewish. And I like to be Jewish and I want to be Jewish.
And this was specifically on your mother's side.
On my mother's side was like the teensy little question mark that I never told anybody that I had in my little heart. So then the DNA tests are sitting on the thing and I'm like, okay, it's expiring, right? So then the other Jewish part of my neurosis kicked in and I was like, well, this is going to expire. I'm going to waste my money. That's not what we do, right? We use the thing before it expires. Mm-hmm. So we finally went on a trip to America on our last trip, and on our last like hour and our last trip to America, I was like, okay, Yishai, get some spit together. And we spit into these things and we marked them down and we registered them online and we sent them in the mail.
First thing we had to do, a very un-Jewish thing, is we had to not eat for
30
minutes.
For 30 minutes, which was a long time.
That's right. It was the longest 30 minutes of my life.
Anyway, so, and we were in Brooklyn at the time also to add to
a place of plenty of good Jewish food.
Lots of Jewish ice cream and stuff. Yeah. Anyway, so then we spit into the thing and we sent it off. And then I didn't really think of it again. Until you started getting email, like we're parsing your Gedo type, or I don't know what kind of things they tell you in the email. And then I was like, oh man, they're like working on my DNA right now. And then finally you got the big notification, Yishai.
Right. They had mapped my genome. They had figured out my genomitude. I was fully genome compatible. They got it. They got me.
Yeah, they had you locked down.
They knew my stuff. They knew my stuff. They knew my toe hairs. They knew everything about me.
So I was a little nervous, right? Because, you know, you're finding out a lot about yourself right there. And we opened the link to the 23andMe, Yishai, at the 23andMe website.
Right, just to make sure everybody understands, we're talking about mapping your genome.
Right. And they also tell you,
is that the right way to say it, or mapping your genes?
Genes. It's like useful in a few ways. One is that the more people who participate in this kind of thing, the more they can like link people together and determine who is a relative. Also, they can tell you things about your health. For example, if you're a carrier for one of like several, you know, genetic diseases, or what you're like, if you have an increased risk of different things later in life or now in life or whatever, whether you need to kind of like think about doing something for your health. And it tells you what your matrilineal line is. And if you're a boy and you have a Y chromosome, then it also tells you about your patrilineal line and tells you like information about where you're from. Mm-hmm. So we took this test pretty much feeling relatively confident that we knew where we're from. I mean, for the last hundreds of years anyway. But still, you know, there's that uncertainty. We talked to some friends.
Hundreds of years?
A couple hundred years, maybe.
Not even. I don't know.
Or 150 years.
Yeah, I know where my like great-grandparents are from, but you know. But,
yeah,
but, but right. It's not like.
Right, it's not solid. It's not solid. And they don't tell you on that level. It's not like they give you the chart. I wish that it gave you like a family tree.
But that's a different, that you could do that.
So we got to do
that. That's Jewish Gen. That's
genealogy. I went to Jewish Gen today. I couldn't understand, like, it's not a genetic thing.
It's not.
It's like where you write down who your parents were and then other people write down who their parents were.
But if you write enough names, it starts to link you in to a whole ancestry.
That's cool.
It's not a genetic thing at all.
I see. It's like a group.
It's like a family
crowdsourced family tree.
Yeah, crowdsourced family
tree. That's cool.
Anyway.
So we opened your page, Yishai.
They opened my page.
And to see what you are exactly.
Right. And I'm like
talked to some friends earlier in the day who were like, it said that we're like a high percentage Jewish and then like 1% Viking. And we're like, okay.
Right. And I was like, my family comes from Russia and Poland. And I was thinking, I don't know, you know, maybe I have a Tatar or some kind of, you know, some other gene that snuck in there.
I mean, your nose is relatively small.
Yeah. Yeah. And now this is, again, God forbid not to disparage anybody, but we have a blessing that we say, thank you, God, that you did not make me one of the Gentiles. Okay. Because it is a privilege to be a Jew and it is a privilege to be a Gentile and a human being for sure.
Yeah, but we like our job.
We appreciate our job. And it's an honor just to be nominated. So I was a little bit like, I could be anything. Now, my disposition is such that it wasn't going to really bother me. I might have even taken a bit of pride if I had a little bit of Viking in me and then would have like researched Viking history or something like that. But it turned out that I was 99.9 Ashkenazi Jewry.
Mazal tov. And we were like, whoa, that is very Jewish.
Right. And I was, you know, and I'm like, wow. And so it's 99.9%, you know, like that. That's what you are.
You're a Jew, dude.
You're a Jew. And I felt so good about myself. And I was just like.
Started gloating.
I wasn't really gloating vis-a-vis myself. Because for me, I'm telling you, if it would have told me that I'm 80% Jewish, I'd have been like, okay, great. You know what I mean? And I would have been actually proud of my Irish, Scottish, Celtic heritage, okay, or something like that.
But nay,
I'm not a Highlander.
Yeah, sorry.
So, although
you're a Dead Sea diver, Yishai.
Right. Although I thought that the scotch that I drank I'm not a big scotch guy, but I did drink scotch this last Shabbat.
It didn't influence the genetics.
And truthfully, scotch doesn't work on me, and that's another proof.
Little Manischewitz, much better.
Okay. So, in any case, I was 99. Now, I wasn't gloating vis-a-vis myself. But it was funny to me that you got this face on that you were like, oh, my God, they're going to discover that there is something wrong with my side, as you mentioned before. And so then I was feeling like a bar of ivory soap. I was 99.44% pure, you know.
Wow.
And it made me laugh a little bit. And I felt
then I had not gotten my results also.
I felt that I'd one-upped you. And as being a person who's married, we all know.
Right, you got to leverage what you can.
That is a pleasure. So I was enjoying that feeling that I was better than you, okay?
Right. And I got nervous.
I thought to myself, there's no way she's going to beat me now. The best she could hope for is to
like
match
99.9.
And she's not going to match it.
There's no way. And that's what I also felt.
Right.
I also felt that there is no way.
And they had delayed.
That I could match. And they delayed. And I'm like, that's it. They delayed because my DNA is so
complex,
full of random stuff,
right,
that it's like they have to sit down with their calculators and work it all out. Moreover, probably I'm a carrier for like 100 billion things, and then they have to write all that down.
I did suspect you of being more of a genetic mutt carrying stuff.
That's disgusting.
You
at two, Yishai.
You know, you admit it. You thought to yourself.
Then I started a little bit refreshing the 23andMe page without telling you because I was like, when are my results coming in? When are my results coming in? I started to get nervous, and then it told me that my results are like 9 more days away. I was like, I can't wait 9 days. I'm not going to sleep. Anyway, today in the morning, I refreshed it one more time, and there it was. My results were in. And I was like, oh, my God. I said a little prayer. I definitely had, like, one or two heart palpitations. And then I opened to Ishai.
Yeah.
And I was like, Ishai, whatever's going to happen, Ishai's just going to rub it in for the rest of my life that he's 99.9% Ashkenazi Jewish. So I opened my results. And I am 100% Ashkenazi Jewish.
Oh, my God. I couldn't
believe
that. That
is 100.0%. So you had your 0.1% is fine, Ishai. They couldn't identify it. It was some kind of like gruel of humanity. Dude. That got, you know, dude, maybe it's Neanderthal.
There's a word for it. It's called alloy, okay? You don't want
to
wear...
Just to strengthen it. You don't want to wear 24K.
For karat gold.
No, you want to wear 14K.
It's like a nice shirt that has like 1% spandex.
Yeah, it gives it a little stretch.
That's right.
I have no stretch in my genetics. Interestingly, by the way, you're not a carrier for like anything. Congratulations. Yeah, I don't know if we need to share this with people. But I like you had and you're not like at no increased risk for anything bad. I like had a little bit of like scruffiness in my health report
because you're 100%
not
so
terrible,
you
not
got,
terrible
because you got no
Baruch
stress.
Hashem.
You got
Baruch
no stress.
Hashem. Yeah, it's just like a lot of inbreeding. So then you get stuff.
Oh
but
my
yeah,
God.
it was exciting. And then wait. So here was the last bit. But then I was like, here's me. Right. I'm like 100%. But that can't be like. All the, like 100% is 100%. And then there's this like way to manipulate the thing so you can like at like make it worse or something. You can like say like less certainty or whatever. And then it was like if you do it to maximum uncertainty level, which I didn't all the way understand, but if you do it to maximum uncertainty level, then I got to like 98.2%. And then I was like, that's it. That's the 1.8. The 1.8, that's definitely the not Jewish part.
Yeah.
But then they group you into your haplotypes, haplogroups. So like I said, the Y chromosome, it's like where you're like the maternal haplogroup is like where your mother's 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 mother infinity is from. And your paternal
not infinity.
Not infinity until whenever Chava, right? Until
right.
Eve. Then the male, the Y chromosome, which I obviously don't have, so couldn't check, goes back to your father's 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 hundreds of generations back.
My father's father.
Yeah, father's father's father.
Yeah.
If you can tell me, by the way, where that is from, I will send you some big prize. If you can tell me where my father's father's father is from, I'm giving you no more clues. Then I send you something huge.
There is one
okay?
clue. I'll give one clue, which
no.
is it's related to what Ishai and Malka think and do.
Yes.
Fine. It's within our...
It's within our realm. It's within the realm. It's not outside the realm.
Right,
okay, that's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Good one, Malka.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to get it, but we'll see. Okay. So then I checked my maternal haplogroup. Okay, this is it. Like, where does my mother's mother's mother come from? Because this is like the big question mark. I want to know. And I find I can't remember what it's called, K1N9. I don't remember what it is. So some haplogroup. And I clicked on that. They're like, this haplogroup is really, really Jewish. They're like, learn about etrogs and this Yiddish word and all this stuff. They're like trying to teach me about my heritage. And it turns out that my mother's 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 mother comes from like a very like well-known, like it has yichus. It has like it's a well-known Jewish woman haplogroup. And I was like, thank you, Lord, because the Lord knows that I'm neurotic. Okay. And then I would
that,
never
by the way,
give
is
myself
also part of that haplogroup.
Any peace.
That's right.
Interestingly, I told my sister, I'm like, I got this DNA test. And it's like, I told her a little bit about it, that we have this haplogroup and everything. She's like, that's where my anxiety and craziness comes from, isn't it? I'm like, yes, it is. That's where it comes.
Where?
She said the same thing. You're like, that's where the neurosis comes from the maternal haplogroup.
Yeah.
My sister said the same exact thing.
Yeah.
It turns out that my mother's 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 mother is Jewish. So congratulate me, everybody.
Congratulations.
And I can sleep now. I can go to sleep tonight.
I don't want to hurt any of our Gentile listeners' feelings.
No, I definitely don't.
No, but it's just
It's just that this is a thing that as Jewish people, you become...
we're a tribe.
Yeah.
We're a tribe. And it's
and
really...
And the Judaism goes down by the mother.
Yeah.
And for other people, I asked a friend of ours who was over for Shabbat recently. I'm like, well, what about people who are not from, one of these Jewish haplogroups? And they're like, yeah, those are our righteous converts. And I'm like, yeah, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Our converts are one of the most beautiful part of our mm-hmm. of our family.
Wait a minute, and was my haplogroup cool or what?
So I looked at your haplogroup. The word Jewish did not appear in your description of your haplogroup, but then I did a little research online for you, and it turns out, Ishai, that your maternal haplogroup is from there's like two groups of people of Jews who like kind of have more people from this haplogroup. One is Iranian Jews, and one is Bulgarian Jews. Bulgaria, incidentally, not so far. It's like an Eastern European country, so sure. That's where maybe it originated from. Was from a little bit outside the. I mean, your
Bulgaria,
mother's
parts of Bulgaria.
Basically,
parts
your mother
of Rome.
Told me that you're like the history of the women in the family is very very long in Russia and that whole area. So.
Just so you know, Bulgaria was originally was a Roman colony. It was a Roman colony originally. And they still have some.
Maybe you're Iranian, Ishai.
Iranian?
I don't know.
Anyway.
That'd be cool.
I don't know. I'm sure.
Or maybe you're Bulgarian.
I don't know. Anyway, if you folks out there have a little bit more clue about this 23andMe or the other ones. For example, my mom said to me that Heritage, she read that Heritage is a better, a more kind of thorough... genetic understanding of things, or if you've been involved in see my friends, I have a few people who got really involved in Jewish gen and really found documents of their the great grandparents coming on Ellis Island and all kinds of ship manifests and all kinds of stuff like that. Really cool stuff, and it's all online today. People really do some research. They get really really into it and they find where they're from.
Well, our friends, our Jewish friends who found out that they're part Viking, they like couldn't be happier. They're so excited that they're part Viking. It's like much more fun for them now than it was when they thought that they were just regular European Jews.
Yeah, they're reading Beowulf and everything. It's great.
Yeah, they're wearing those hats with the horns.
One cool thing was that they were like, well, there's one family member that you definitely have, and it was my cousin.
Right? Yeah, the machine found your cousin. The website also found my cousin. He just put an initial for his last name, but since I know what his last name is, then I saw that my cousin has also done 23.
I do want to tell you, by the way, that while you were gone today, you did get a kind of spam type email through the 23andMe system of somebody like some kind of inappropriate.
What?
Yes. Yeah, no. Yes. Yes. Asking for your information. So, anyway. Yeah. Yeah. It was.
What does that mean?
Let's just say it's not.
This is family stuff, people.
Yeah. Well, let me just say it's not invaluable. Whatever it is. It's. Watch out over there.
All right.
23andMe is. You don't want to be showing your genes to everybody. Let's put it that
seriously,
way.
Seriously. Keep it in your jeans.
That's right. Keep your jeans in your jeans. All right. So congratulations to Malka and myself.
Yes.
And congratulations to our children, I guess.
And congratulations to everybody, because the truth is we come from a great big pool of humanity, and everyone's got a really interesting story.
Yeah.
Our story happens to be a European shtetl story.
I don't know. I kind of like that's only for the last 2,000 years, but before that we were... in our land for hundreds and hundreds of years. And then before that, we were in Iran, and those
areas.
Right,
it did say that your maternal haplogroup traveled through Egypt, Ishai, which
that's right.
I know is true.
That's right. That's right. No, it literally says move from...
Yeah, move through Egypt.
Right. So that's cool. That's really cool. And I don't think I understand all this stuff yet. I'd like to understand a little bit better, but it's definitely fun. And... we're learning a lot about ourselves, about our psychologies, about what makes up our bodies, about where we come from, about our internet proclivities or whatever it is. There's like a lot of info out there about us.
Yeah. That's why I got nervous. One of the reasons I got nervous about taking this test.
But there is no genotype for God. I'm thinking I might call the show the God's Genotype or the Genotype of God,
You the genotype from God, you won't know it. You won't know it.
God has God's, no DNA. God's or God genome. Is all the DNA. God has not made, well, yeah.
Right, I'm just saying.
No DNA.
Well, the only DNA that he's given us is the Torah. That's his genetic footprint, if you will. That's his mind. That's what he has shared with us. And that's his footprint of genius in this world, and there's also this world, which is a mirror of what he believes in, if you will. Hmm. And that's his imprint on this world. And we could follow it. And inside that is a code. Inside the Torah, there's an incredible right. code. And there's codes upon codes. And it's an incredible document. And I always feel during this time of Elul that, like, all the other things should be set aside and, like, just get back to learning Torah.
Right.
And teaching Torah and just, like, kind of just get through the dross and get to the focus.
Right.
Of understanding his genome. His genome. Meanwhile, back down in reality of the regular, the kind of lower end reality, Israel is still taking rockets, still being attacked.
Right.
There's another genome. There's another kind of code, which is the code of anti-Semitism, the anti-code, the code of Amalek, which is in this week's Torah portion. The genome of Amalek. By the way, we kind of know the genome of Amalek. We know where he comes from, you know, through Esau's line, and then through Agag, King Agag, who's not killed, and then through Haman. You know, we follow him down the line as well, and he matches our genome out there, and he's out there, and then they came the Nazis, you know, and they're out there, and they're trying, and then they have their theories of racial superiority and all this kind of stuff, and they're out there trying to destroy the Jewish people, and they're trying to destroy our line, our seed, and really the genome of Messiah. Can I call the show that the genome of Messiah?
You can call it whatever you want.
Messiah's genome and Amalek's genome. It's all out there. So that's it, Malka. I want to really thank you, and I want to tell you that we shan't have a show before elections.
Oh my golly!
Yet another way.
The next show is gonna be like when they've probably already tallied everything and stuff.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Be on the edge of that, yeah.
We got to see all the votes, I guess, are the genome of the election. Whoa, we could talk about genomes forever.
Yeah. Well, because in many ways, it's a way of deciphering what it's all made up of. And I just had a reporter said to me, many polls show that Israel's for the two-state solution. I go, there is a actual poll of this country that you could trust. It's called Elections.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah. I'm like,
I heard that Avigdor Lieberman wants to make elections in Israel mandatory. Did you hear that?
Elections or voting?
Voting, not elections.
There's
always
somebody that's talking about that.
I think that's a horrible idea.
In Australia, they have like 100% voting because it's criminal not to vote.
I think that's craziness.
But then they have a different problem, which is like people show up drunk.
And they vote for stuff that they don't want. I think if you don't want to use your vote, bye-bye. You don't use your vote. I'll use your vote. I don't literally use your vote, but I'll use my vote, and my vote will count, and your vote will not count.
It's an interesting question, which I haven't thought through totally. So I don't.
I can't imagine making it mandatory for someone to decide who they want to be the leader of the country. You don't know what kind of mindset somebody's in when they're forced into a vote.
Forced in. It's not like
literally. You go to jail or pay a fine or something if you don't do it.
Yeah. So let's say it's a small fine. It's just a something that kind of is a motivator. Or let's say you would get a positive motivation. So you would get a tax credit if you voted or something. You know, it's like
that's not the same as making voting mandatory.
I'm saying that there's ways to
push people to vote. I never heard that you had to like force Jews to express their opinion. That's like a first time. That's a first time piece of
voting
information.
Around the world is dropped because people are they don't have a lot of faith in the system and they don't feel like it.
Okay,
so,
but that's also a vote.
Yeah,
it's also an expression of their democratic opinion or whatever?
It's not
allowed to express themselves.
It's an interesting question. I'd love to hear from our listeners about that. That's an interesting question. I haven't read the various kind of positions on that. I'd like to hear more about that. Why how it works in different countries. Australia seems to continue to survive, even though
Australia has no natural predators, Ishai. It's not the same thing. Here we have to make serious decisions.
All right. It's still a country of that has to make serious decisions. Still people living on a land and have to live as best as possible. In any case, very interesting question. You can really write to me and to Malka through my email, which is Yishai@thelandofisrael.com, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And you can reach out to us through Facebook and through Twitter. Malka's still a Twitter queen out there, giving all the bad guys a run for their money. No wonder that Nasrallah hasn't stuck his head out of the bunker. Like, there's a Malka out there.
Just not Malka.
She'll tweet my head off. So keep your head down, Nasrallah, because we're out to get you. And I want to really wish a lot of luck to the state of Israel in its upcoming vote. And I want to really bless the leaders of Israel to be not just political, but also leaders, and to have a great and deep motivation to move our beloved nation forward. And we ask God that he gives us great leaders so that we can fulfill his plan quicker and better,
amen,
safer. And
more like he likes.
And I want to say thank you very much to both the genetically Jewish people, those people who have converted into our people, have joined our people, and those people who are not.
All the other
interesting, Jewish
awesome people
race
out there.
/ ethnicity / tribe, but instead, right, all the beloved ones that are friends of the great story. And at the end, Hashem is the decider of who we are.
That's right.
And who we're supposed to be. And I heard
individually and collectively.
What's his name on H.com? There's Charlie Harari, I think.
Okay.
And Leah made me, our daughter made me watch a video that her teacher wanted her to watch. And Charlie Harari tells a great story about how he didn't shoot at the last minute of one game. The coach put him in, and there was 3 seconds to go, and he didn't feel confident, so he passed the ball. The other guy shot and missed.
Oh.
And the coach said to him, you know, you cost us the game.
Oh.
Because you didn't have belief in yourself. Next time, though, you should know this. I've been coaching for 30 years, and if I put you on the court for that last minute, it's because I've got faith in you. So next time, if you don't have faith in yourself, at least know that I have faith in you. And he says, "Modani lefanecha melechayik v'kem shechzata bin mishpati bechemla rabba emunatecha bechemla rabba emunatecha," which is thank you, God, for giving me my soul back. With mercy, you have great faith in me. And he's like, Hashem has faith in us. Like, if you don't have faith in you, that's one thing. But know that Hashem has faith in us. I thought that was a great message.
Really nice.
I thought it was a great message. So whatever you are, whoever you are, wherever you are, and whatever you need, and whatever is lacking, and whatever you think your powers are, you are here because God has put you on this great earth. Speaking of that, I do want to thank the good folks at the Land of Israel Network and the YishaiFleisher.com system, which is Moshe Herman. God bless you, and thank you so much for helping out the show. Ben Bresky and Tabitha for rocking it and getting it out there on the net waves to the world. I do want to thank the good people at Hebron, the Jewish community of, and the Hebron Fund, which helps keep that engine going. And I really want to recommend that you come on one of our amazing Simcha Hachbound tours at HebronFund.org and come see the forefathers and mothers in Hebron. I want to shout out to the Director General Uri Karzen, and I want to really thank them for the great opportunity of working with them to help develop this beautiful, beautiful ancient holy city. It was also a great pleasure for me to be in Yerushalayim today. Yer HaKodesh, Yerushalayim looks just amazing.
Yeah, it
and beautiful.
Great. Jerusalem is doing awesome.
It's just what a light. What a light to the world. What a light to the world. And the rest of the world, may you all have light out there wherever you are. Stay connected. Stay tuned. Stay part of the story. Stay tuned in to God, who's broadcasting 24/7. Stay powerful. Stay tactical. Don't go changing. And lots of smiles out there because we have a great gift. Malka Fleisher, I want to thank you so much for being with me again.
Thanks, Ishai.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Good news to you all.
Shabbat Shalom.
Israel this past week hosted the 2019 Flag Football European Championship. Josh Haston here, host of Israel Uncensored on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Check out my show this week, an interview with Steve Leibowitz, president of American Football in Israel. Get all the details on this major tournament, first time ever, hosted in the city of Jerusalem. Don't miss my show, Israel Uncensored. I got you covered in the world of flag football, only here on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.